The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Lately, I've been talking with people, some people, about their fear. And so I thought I would talk today about fear. Fear is an area of practice, mindfulness, that I think everyone's going to have to encounter sooner or later. I'd like to think that any spiritual tradition that's worth its salt is will have you encountering fear sooner or later. It's not what people think, because you're supposed to just kind of enter into meditation and go off and float in a cloud and be happy ever after. But it doesn't work that way. I think that what at least Buddhist mindfulness practice is about is really meeting yourself in a deep, integrated way, in such a way to set yourself free, come deep, abiding peace. And so that process involves confronting and meeting fear, which is, I think, almost a universal factor for human beings. So I'd like to start by reading a fairy tale. It's a European fairy tale. It goes like this. There was a beautiful princess who was engaged to a hideous serpent monster. Terrified, she sought the counsel of a wise old witch. The witch told the princess that she should go ahead with the marriage and that she should wear 10 white gowns on her wedding night. When it was time to go to bed with the serpent, she was told she should take off each of her gowns one at a time and ask the serpent to take off one of his skins for each of her dresses. After she took off her 10 gowns, she was to embrace the serpent. The princess didn't like it. But she took the advice of the witch. As she took off the last of her gowns, she saw that the slimy, repulsive serpent was still there. And although she was repulsed, she nevertheless had the wisdom to follow what the witch had said. And she embraced the serpent. When she did, the serpent was transformed into her handsome princely lover. It's a fairy tale, right? In a fairy tale, reluctantly the bridegroom accepts the monster as her bridegroom, and embraces him, goes towards him. But in going towards it, then is willing to strip off her 10 gowns, asking him to do the same. And there's willingness to take off the layers of armor, the layer of defensiveness, the layers of identification that we carry with us, is not an easy process to do. And people feel quite exposed and quite vulnerable. But if we're going to really embrace our monsters, you know, not the external ones, but the internal ones, and have them transformed, there has to be a willingness to meet them, to almost like embrace them, to really be there. If we pull away, run away, if we stay defended, then there can't be that transformation that the fairy tale talks about. And there can be a transformation for us. We don't have to live perpetually in fear. I meet people whose fear was set in motion, set in place, when they were children. And then they become 60, 70, 80 years old, and the fear is still there. Sometimes it comes to the forefront, sometimes it recedes, but it's still, you know, quite solid. And because they've never turned towards, never dealt with it, it continues to be guiding them, influencing them their life. And fear, you know, is, as I said, a common phenomena. Different people have different things that they're afraid of more than others, but there are common fears. In Buddhism, they list 5 common fears. I don't think they're necessarily the universally common ones, but it's an interesting list. Fear of livelihood, loss of livelihood. Fear of loss of reputation. Fear of unusual states of mind. Fear of death. And then fear of public speaking. And I've seen, so that's the ancient India. So I've seen lists of fear in, for modern Americans. And public speaking and death are up there in the top 10. Fear of loss of reputation could be connected to the whole fear of insecurity around how we relate to others. And many people that I know, including myself when I was younger, the whole fear of being rejected was really big. I did all kinds of social gymnastics in order to kind of deal with my fear of being rejected by people. It seems like a very high level, high in that list of top fears is fear of heights, fear of flying, fear of snakes, fear of spiders. Some people have fear of going into public, being in public spaces. There's fear, fear of loss of security, issues around safety. You can go on and on with a list, and probably you have your own list of things that you're afraid of. And then it helps to have a little bit of differentiation with different kinds of fear to know how to address it. There is phobias, which are these recurrent, kind of deeply seated habits that keep reappearing. There's fears that are connected to trauma, which are different than phobia, which are often very need a different way of approaching than maybe ordinary generic fear. When we look at the teachings of the Buddha, there's an interesting practice that he offers that I become increasingly aware that because as I read more and more of the teachings of the Buddha, this stood out as something he says repeatedly that none of my teachers ever mentioned. And none of the books, I've read a lot of books on Buddhism, right? Never mentioned. It's like we have a selective ability to, most religious peoples pick and choose through their scriptures selectively, right? So Buddhists do that too. But there's, and then we leave things out. So there's one thing we've left out as far as I could see, the places I've encountered Buddhism. And that is the Buddha had this threefold kind of understanding that people should have about all kinds of issues in their life. And this is, and he says this repeatedly about many different things. And one should know the enjoyment or the benefits of the thing. One should know the danger of the thing. And one should know the escape from the thing. So Bhikkhu Bodhi translates the gratification, the danger, and the benefit. Someone else translates the second one, danger, as the downside or the downfall or something. So these three things, it's kind of interesting. So we begin here with looking at fear in a more cognitive way, kind of understanding way. And how do we understand fear? So rather than having a simplistic idea that fear is bad and we have to get rid of it, we begin the analysis by asking, what are the benefits of fear? What's the gratification that comes with fear? And in this regard, Buddhism lists two fears, which it considers to be the guardians of the world. So the protectors of the world, and this has to do with the fear of wrongdoing, fear of harming others. A certain kind of fear where you feel like you're about to do something that you're going to cause harm to others or cause harm to yourself, and the kind of pulling back of fear. So both fear of what we're going to do and fear of doing it into the future, fear of the consequences. And this is considered a healthy fear. If you feel afraid to go and rob your neighbor, and I'm going to practice Buddhism and overcome my fear, so I can be a better robber. This is not what Buddhist practice is about. In fact, a certain kind of fear gets stronger, I think, the more a person becomes relaxed and settled and sensitive to their inner workings. And the fear of wrongdoing, the fear of causing harm, increases with time. Not in a debilitating way, but hopefully in a supportive way for our lives. It protects the world to do this. And then we have fears that clearly protect us in situations which are quite dangerous. And in terms of children, there are children who grow up in horrendous situations. Last night we had a memorial service here, and people talked about the person who died as having grown up in some of the worst possible circumstances. They said it was worse than concentration camps. But the person was one of the most joyous and happy and generous and kindest people that the people at the memorial had ever met and heard. But so terrible things happen, and one of the ways that children protect themselves is by being afraid. Because being afraid, it's helpful to be afraid in dangerous situations. You keep your guard up. You're looking out and making sure that when the alcoholic parent comes home and is going to be angry, that you hear the footsteps and you know how to be really quiet and disappear to your room because of that fear. And so growing up as a child, sometimes certain kinds of fears have the benefit of protecting the child. But in the process, that fear gets kind of reinforced and strengthened. And so by the time a person becomes adult and they're no longer living in that household and that situation, the habit of fear is still quite strong, is still operating, and it becomes something how they orient themselves to the world, and they carry that fear with them in the world, even though the danger is long past. But to appreciate the benefit that comes from fear, when it does in fact protect us, I think is a way of, is really beneficial. I know one practice where people practice thanking their fear. When it's an ancient fear that benefited themselves long ago, when they come into the future, into the present, when they still comes up, and fear is not necessary anymore, rather than feeling ashamed or feeling bad about it being there, offering gratitude to the fear for the service it provided long ago. So there are benefits that can come, and so it's useful to look at that and see. One of the interesting questions around the benefits of fear is it, even when it is beneficial, are there other approaches that are more beneficial? Even though the fear might get you out of danger, are there wiser ways of getting out of danger? If you're afraid of having a conversation with someone because you're in conflict, the fear might prevent you from having the conversation and therefore you stay safe. And I've known people who've stayed safe in their marriage for decades, rather than have the conversation that you probably should have. And because they're afraid of what disruption is going to have. But are there other ways of having a conversation that is not going to disrupt the relationship? Are there ways of entering into what needs to be addressed that rather than pulling away and not doing it because of the fear? And so how do we learn the skills? How do we learn the ability to turn towards our fear? How do we analyze the situation, turn towards what we're afraid of, and try to understand, are there other approaches that we can protect ourselves and feel, get the same benefit that we're trying to do through acting on our fear, I think is part of a wise life. So when we look at fear, and I think part of mindfulness practice is to look at it, is to stop, take a look, get interested in it. And it's really wonderful, I think, the opportunities that meditation provides in our life. One of the opportunities of meditation is that ideally you do your meditation practice in a situation where you feel safe. So the privacy of your bedroom, perhaps, or hopefully you come to a meditation center like IMC and you feel safe enough. And you do it someplace where the time and the place where you feel safe and where you're going to be safe. And then you sit down, in that environment, because the situation is safe, perhaps it becomes a safe enough place to begin turning towards the things that normally we don't feel comfortable turning towards and looking at. So to sit there, and if fear arises, not to run away from it, but to turn towards it. And maybe a turn towards it first kind of tenderly, carefully. Maybe from a distance even. You don't have to kind of, you know, dive right into the depth of your greatest fear, but to begin kind of skirting the edges of it, getting to know it. What's going on here? And perhaps because you recognize you're in a safe place, that maybe you're willing to open up to it in a way that you wouldn't. It doesn't make sense to do so if you're out in the world where it's still maybe the situation is dangerous. And so the mindfulness practice is a great place to turn towards things. The mindfulness meditation, and begin finding our way through it. And then finding our way through it, it might be nice to use the categories of the mind, the body, and the heart as a way to kind of enter into it. And part of the advantage of this kind of breaking it into these three parts is that fear is usually a composite. Fear is not a unitary single event, but it's usually made up of many different factors coming together, and as they come together, the fear arises and becomes quite intense. Can become intense. So we start breaking it up a little bit, seeing what's going on here. Makes it easier sometimes to address. So the mind, for the purposes of the talk, I like to say the mind has a lot to do with our beliefs and ideas of around fear. And so it's generally the people who are struggling with fear in their lives, in the people I encounter here, are not living in situations of war, not living in situations of ongoing danger moment by moment in their lives. And so a lot of their fear, a lot of their anxiety is imaginary, belongs to the world of ideas, and they imagine what's going to happen in the future. Anxiety is usually defined as fear of something that's going to happen in the future. It's imaginary. It might have some truth to it, but we have to use our imagination to project into the future. So what is the role of your imagination? What's the role of ideas you have in becoming afraid? What do you think is going to happen when you walk in the dark? What are the beliefs that go on? If you're afraid of social encounters, what are the ideas and beliefs that are coming into play in that social encounter? So, for example, I had fear about being rejected, and so I had a lot of ideas about what it meant to be in relationship to other people, how people saw me, how I wanted people to see me. I had ideas about how people would respond and react to what I said and what I did. And I had the brilliant idea that people would reject me if they got to know me. So, that's a dangerous idea to have. So, the best thing to do is not let people know you're right. And then people will like you. But if they like you, what are they liking? Is it you? It's kind of like you can't win, right? Because if you don't show people who you are and they like you, they don't really like you. They like something else. And so they don't really know you. And so then you're in a morass. So to look, what are we believing? What are the ideas? One of the strong forms of fear for some people is has to do with identification. What we identify with, so how we like to represent ourselves, and fear of losing that identification, fear of that being threatened in some way. Some of the identity issues that can be threatened is we might have a value, an idea that we're supposed to be seen as competent. And if other people don't see us as competent, then the situation becomes frightening, or I'm afraid of myself if I don't hold myself up as a competent person. Or I need to be smart, or I need to be beautiful. I've known people who, as they get older, the beauty that they were so strongly identified with begins to change. I like to say that it changes into a different kind of beauty. But some people are slow on the uptake, and they're and so they somehow don't recognize the new forms of beauty that are coming as they get wrinkled and sag, and all kinds of natural processes begin happening. And so there's fear of that loss of beauty, because not because the beauty itself, but because the impact it's going to have on our social world. If we're not seen, if we don't have the identity of being a beautiful person, then certainly people reject us, because people accept us and like us because of our beauty, the smoothness of our skin or something. I hope this is okay to say. There was a woman who came to IMC for a while, and she didn't like coming here so much. Because a high percentage of the women who came here didn't wear much makeup and let their hair go gray. And this was kind of upsetting for her, because, how are you going to get a man if you let yourself go that way? So, you know, we're kind of like a little sub-cult of our society that tends. And then when I was at Zen Center, and then it was a nice other reverse. Remember, I was at San Francisco Zen Center many years ago, in the 80s. And there also, you know, weren't supposed to wear makeup and stuff. And you know, supposed to dress up like a, you know, very feminine ways. And then there was this wonderful Zen teacher from Boston named Maureen Stewart, who came to visit, and she wore her Zen robes like this beautiful, elegant dress, and she wore makeup, and it was liberating for these Zen women back then. You can do that? They'd been afraid in that kind of setting, so it goes in both directions, right? So what are the beliefs that you have? What are you afraid of? And it's a useful exercise to go home and actually write out what you're afraid of, because there's a lot of inarticulated fears that people carry. People often haven't really named them from themselves. They're kind of there in the background operating. But it makes a big difference to write it down and actually see what they are. And then once you see what they are, to ask around them, what are the beliefs you have that support those fears? What are the beliefs that are around those fears? Where did you learn that kind of fear is an interesting question, because where you learned it from sometimes has to do with the beliefs that we have. Sometimes it's learned from family, from different places. I still remember, I don't think I'm afraid anymore, but it kind of had a deep imprint on me, was when I went to elementary school in the early 1960s, we had these nuclear holocaust, drills. everyone under the desk, and we'd all, had to kind of go under the desk and put our hands over our necks and protect ourselves from the nuclear kind of bombs that were going to go off in the neighborhood. So that was quite an impression on me in terms of, and when I, still there a little bit, because I've gone a few times into my son's elementary school classroom, and that memory of those drills and how it impacted me still comes up for me. Oh, it's an elementary school classroom. Where's the desks? So, where do we learn these things? Where do they come from? And then we have help with our fears, right? There's lots of people who spend a lot of time trying to help us be afraid. And so there's politicians that are helping us be afraid. And so, and then there's, I don't know if they're, we get a lot of help. I don't watch television, but I know people who watch local news on television. And it seems like there's a strong correlation between some of my relatives and their fear of the neighborhood, their fear of this and that, because these things get sensationalized on the news. And so it seems to them that these dangers are around every corner because of how, they take us in from their news. So where do we learn our fears? Where do they come from? What's the basis for them? So that's the kind of the mind. And then the body. There's a great expression from the Buddha called becoming a body witness. Isn't that a great term, body witness? So what we try to do, what we learn to do in mindfulness practice is to be mindful through our body, with our body. So to turn towards our physical experience in relationship to fear and learn how to a degree of comfort with our fear or ability to kind of really feel and sense how it's being lived in the body. And there's some advantages of that. One advantage is the bodily expression of fear is not really a story. The story kind of belongs to the mind. And so if we can turn away from the story and turn towards the actual way it's being experienced in the present moment and learn how to be comfortable with that or learn how to be wise with that or present for that, be a witness for it, then the physical sensations of fear stop becoming such a strong catalyst for perpetuating the fear. And I believe there's a way in which the physical sensations of fear are often the fuel for the stories, for the ideas, or further fear. And if we could stop and be still and feel and sense the fear in the body and learn how to be still and quiet, to give space for it and be equanimous about it, that then the triggering mechanism of the physical sensations of fear don't operate so strongly. In fact, the opposite can begin happening, and that is the physical sensations can begin to dissipate, can relax. So some people feel fear in their stomach, commonplace. So the idea in mindfulness practice is to drop down and put the attention as close to that area of the stomach as feels comfortable. Some people will put it right in the middle. The great thing I like to think of is to put your attention right in the middle of your fear and be still. Just be still. Nothing has to happen. You don't have to do anything. Just put yourself right in the middle of it and be still. And, you know, it might be hard at first to sit still, but just sit there with it, be with it. There's something very powerful that happens when we just accompany our fear in the body. We're witnessing it. Just be with it for a while. There's fear in the heart, in the shoulders. There's fear, you know, all kinds of places that people feel it. And an interesting place to watch for anxiety and fear is in the hands. If you practice mindfulness of your hands as you go through your day, how often do your hands start doing interesting, fingers doing interesting things and clasping, and what does that represent? If you make a habit of mindfulness of the body in daily life, you probably catch the symptoms, the signs of anxiety or fear earlier than you would otherwise. That was true for me, that as I became more and more aware of my body and made a habit of tuning into my body through my day, I started to notice the little twinges of fear and tightness and energy and agitation that came up, that then told me, pay attention now. What's going on now? But if I didn't pay attention to my body, it was easy to be preoccupied and caught up in what's going on and didn't notice that I was anxious. So to become a body witness, to learn how to be present and feel it, is not an easy thing to do when the fear is strong. And so sometimes what's useful to do is to be mindful, is to notice, be with the fear of the fear. And sometimes the secondary fear of the fear is comfortable to be with. I can be with that, fear of fear, and just be with that, feel what that's like. And when that dissipates, then maybe it's a little easier to get closer to the fear that we have. Sometimes fear, as we open to it in the body, becomes stronger, and so then it becomes maybe useful to make sure that you have support for yourself so you can open to it. Maybe have extra time at the end of your meditation if that's where you're opening to it, so you can kind of decompress or kind of work off the energy. Or maybe you have a friend that's available that you can talk to if it gets really difficult, so you have someone, you know, to check in with. So kind of the body, using the body, such an important support for this. The third aspect is that of the heart. And what I mean, I don't know what I mean by the heart exactly, but the heart I associate with kind of the deepest emotional kind of base for fear, the deepest kind of source within us. And this is a place maybe in the mind or in the amygdala or someplace that can heal or settle or resolve or stop its regular kind of patterning of reinforced fear and anxiety. And this is where the heart can come to peace, settle. The heart can be at home in itself, feel safe in itself. And a number of things support this. One is meditation practice can be very helpful when we're able to get concentrated and still, independent of looking at our fear. There is something called a bypass, which can be useful. Sometimes it's useful to avoid certain issues in our life temporarily, consciously, and avoid it and get really have a deep sense of well-being, get concentrated, still, do something that makes us feel really good and safe. And then from that deep, safe place, then to open up and turn and look at the fear. Sometimes if we look at fear in a fearful state, it can just be kind of re-triggering and make it more difficult. And so sometimes there's this wise bypassing. Some people will do this with a variety of concentration practices, like just concentrating their breath or doing loving kindness practice. Some people find it useful to go on retreats. Some people find it useful to go into nature and get away from their life as usual. In order to kind of somehow get away from the things that keep us in this kind of momentum of fear. But then not to then unconsciously go back into situations where fear kind of pops up, but to go back consciously knowing, now I'm going to watch and be present for the fear from this place of feeling good and well-being. And then to slowly be able to have the capacity to be really still in the midst of the fear. Because when we can be really still in the midst of the fear, still means not acting on it, not reacting to it, not needing it to be anything, not interpreting it, not making stories about it, not pushing it down, not celebrating it, not acting on it, just letting the fear be. Letting the fear be. And have the confidence and the trust to just be present for it. And because all our emotions are processes, no emotion is ever stuck unless we hold it in place, hold it stuck. And as we learn to let go and get out of the way, then the emotions that are stuck inside us or are habitual begins to unravel, begins to dissolve, begins to dissipate. And to have a repeated experience of strong fear dissipate, it's kind of like getting a massage for the heart. And you might have to do it over and over again, and slowly the heart begins to realize it's okay to stay relaxed, it's okay to stay relaxed. You don't have to be afraid. You don't have to be afraid. And then when the heart really understands the depth of peace, then comes a very special moment. And that special moment is when you realize that at your core of who you are, that core cannot be threatened by anything. That there's something inside of you that cannot be threatened by anything, no matter what happens, not by death, not by war, not by rejection, not by people's anger, not by failure. That something inside of us, to touch that core, to know that place of purity or stillness or freedom, then changes our relationship to the world, to the fear, to ourselves. Because when we know that there's something that is not threatenable, we have a lot of confidence, a lot of sense of security as we go through our lives. So those are my thoughts about fear. And I offer them to you as an encouragement to kindly, compassionately spend some time with your fears and see what they are. Look at them. Look at them more carefully and see if you can see beyond them to the other side of them. So, so we have the second Sunday tea today. And in order to help you confront your fears, I mean, the last thing, you know, is to talk to people. That's frightening. It would be nice, especially since some people are new here, I think just to, if you don't mind, just turn towards someone near you, introduce yourself and say hello. And if you have been here for a while, welcome them. Even if you only came last time and the person here is the first time, welcome them. And if you want to say something about the talk, to you're welcome to do that. But it's nice to welcome and say hello. And then everyone's welcome to stay for the tea, please. So, thank you.